Appendix. Nostos. The ancient Greeks had a word for the hero's journey home, their voyage of peril, temptation, loss, yearning, and epic adventure. The word was nostos. Thousands of years later, it was to be combined with the Greek for longing, sorrow, and pain, algia, to form the new word nostalgia, coined in 1688 by a Swiss academic to describe the acute homesickness suffered by Swiss mercenary soldiers pining not quite for the fjords, but for the peaks and valleys of their native Alps. Slowly, nostalgia evolved to extend its meaning to a longing for a time as much as a place. Homer's epic poem, The Iliad, begins with rage, the rage of Achilles that propels the entire epic. The Odyssey begins with a personality and a sense of sorrow, suffering, setback, and longing. These are more complex emotions than sheer rage. The Iliad is certainly not without psychological realism and moments of human behavior that we can closely identify with. But the Odyssey, with its subtle, ambiguous, shifting, and complex hero, not to mention its abandonment of the Iliad's unities of time and place in favor of flashbacks and flashes forward, strikes us as a more modern, novelistic, or perhaps cinematic achievement. Before he finds his way to his proper hearthside, at last in the company of his wife and son, the hero faces not only physical challenges and obstacles, but painful moral choices, to which there can be no truly right answer. Of course, Troy gave rise to more journeys home than just that of Odysseus. The story of Idomeneus's return to his home island, Crete, was the subject of post-Homeric authors and, centuries later, of Mozart's opera, Idomeneo. Menelaus and Helen's Nostos is described by Menelaus himself in the first part of the Odyssey, often called the Telemachy, which follows Telemachus's journey to visit Pylos and Sparta in search of his father. Virgil's Aeneid is a Nostos epic whose hero is in search of a new home, forming the foundational nostalgia legend for the Romans. Another great and terrible Nostos story connected to the Trojan War concerns what befalls Agamemnon and his family, a subject important enough in Athenian culture for the three great contemporaneous 5th century BC dramatists, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, each to have treated the subject. Aeschylus's trilogy of the Oresteia comprises the plays Agamemnon, his murder at the hands of Clytemnestra and Aegisthus, Choephori, the libation bearers, Orestes' return to Mycenae and the revenge killing, and the Eumenides, the pursuit of Orestes by the Furies and the judgment of Athena on the hill of Ares. Both Sophocles and Euripides wrote an Electra. The Austrian novelist and dramatist Hugo von Hofmannsthal took his own play, Electra, and adapted it for Richard Strauss, whose opera of the same name remains one of the most shattering and shocking experiences that can be had in a theatre. Euripides took on the story of Iphigenia's arrival in Aulis to be sacrificed, following Agamemnon's killing of the sacred deer, as well as Pylades and Orestes' quest for the statue of Artemis and their discovery of Orestes' long-lost sister. The plays Iphigenia in Aulis and Iphigenia in Tauris, respectively. E.T. Phone Home. Nostos is a common enough theme, or, to use the currently beloved word, a favoured trope in high and popular art. A good example might be Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit, whose subtitle is There and Back Again. Paulo Coelho's extraordinarily popular The Alchemist follows the same rhythms of a quest outwards and a return homewards. The reward, the treasure, it turns out in tales like these, is not on top of some distant golden hill, but lies, and always did, at home. The Wizard of Oz is another explicit example of this Nostos mytheme. The incantation, "There's no place like home, there's no place like home," returns Dorothy to Kansas. In case we haven't got the idea, her last words are, "Oh, Auntie M, there's no place like home." We can add The Tempest, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Apollo 13, Finding Nemo, Cold Mountain, Planes, Trains and Automobiles, Lion, based on a book with a very Nostos title, A Long Way Home, and many other popular films and stories. Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey, isn't really comprehensible unless one bears that subtitle in mind. The Coen brothers' O Brother, Where Art Thou? Is a self-conscious relocation of the Odyssey to the Depression-era Deep South. George Clooney's Ulysses McGill has a wife called Penny back home who is courted by suitors, and he encounters a one-eyed Polyphemus character, memorably played by John Goodman, as well as some washboard-playing sirens who try to tempt him away from his journey home. I'm sure we could all add various films, books, graphic novels and TV series to the list of Nostos-inflected stories. Lost in Space, Star Trek Voyager, Lost, Homeland, and many others. Colm Tóibín's Brooklyn and Long Island brilliantly express the ambiguous but irresistible desire for home felt by their protagonist Eilish. But the Irish novel that most completely and deliberately echoes the narrative shape of Homer's original is, of course, James Joyce's Ulysses. Regarded by many as being as momentous a landmark in modern literature as its forebear was in ancient. Over the course of one June day in Dublin in the year 1904, Bloomsday, a father finds a kind of son, and the son a kind of father, each of which they had long needed without knowing. This forms the emotional core of Ulysses. The Odysseus figure here is the Jewish Dubliner Leopold Bloom, while his wife Molly stands as Calypso at the novel's commencement and Penelope at its conclusion. Telemachus is Stephen Dedalus, the arrogant and brilliant intellectual hero of Joyce's earlier semi-autobiographical work, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Structurally, the novel follows the episodes of the Odyssey, with Joyce giving them directly Homeric titles, such as Lotus Eaters, Laestrygonians, Scylla and Charybdis, Oxen of the Sun, and so on. Since, following on from its nomadic life of hunting and gathering, our branch of humankind first built settlements and hearths, first established ports and trading posts, first ventured and explored, the idea of a return home has burned brightly within us. Whether home is a physical or a spiritual, a real or an imaginary place, our journeys to find it or return to it will always remain, we can be sure, a proper subject for art, music, drama, and entertainment. Homer's Odyssey will eternally stand as the avatar and exemplar, as, appropriately enough, the home of such stories. Even if, as some believe, he never existed, we can agree that for us English speakers at least, the imaginary poet has been given the right name. Homer. As discussed in Troy, the poet Homer, if he lived and breathed at all, was most likely a combination of different rhapsodes, as the epic bards were called. They recited the poems from memory, using the flowing 12 to 17 syllable lines known as dactylic hexameter and the various epithets, descriptive phrases such as the wine-dark sea, grey-eyed Athena, cloud-gatherer Zeus, and perhaps the best-known of them all, Eos Rhododactylos, rosy-fingered Dawn, to aid their performances. Demodocus, the Phaeacian bard whom Odysseus so shockingly interrupts, might be considered a semi-comic self-portrait of Homer himself, as perhaps is the Ithacan minstrel poet Phemius. There are almost as many theories about Homer as there are classical academics in the world. Most believe the Iliad was written, is not the right word, composed before the Odyssey. Some believe that, in fact, only parts of the Odyssey were the work of the Iliad's author, and that it was mostly the creation of somebody, or many somebodies, else. The textual analysis employed by these scholars is detailed, abstruse, and way beyond either my capacity or the scope of this note. Similar quantities of ink have been spilled over the modern-day locations that correspond with the islands and coasts mentioned in the Odyssey. Is today's Ithaca Homer's Ithaca? Some think it is more likely to have been neighbouring Kefalonia, but don't suggest that to an Ithacan. Phaeacia Scheria is believed to be Corfu. Virgil places Scylla and Charybdis in the Straits of Messina, which divide southern Italy from Sicily. Calypso's Ogygia might be Gozo, Malta itself, or even the lost city of Atlantis. Eia, where Circe lived, is said, by the Italians at least, to be Monte Circeo, the southwestern limit of the Pontine Marshes, which Julius Caesar never managed to drain, but Mussolini boastfully did. It is a whole separate game. Fun for those who enjoy such pastimes, but short of fresh archaeological or documentary evidence, hard to prove. Farewell to the gods. Odysseus and Penelope are locked in an embrace by their fireside, while their son Telemachus looks blushingly on. This is the scene we tiptoe away from. This is where the curtain drops on Greek myth. The great arc from the birth of the gods, through the creation of humankind, and the homeward journeys of the Greek heroes, has been completed. Archaeologists, ethnologists, and historians will recognize far more complex shapes, shifts, and turns in the development of Mediterranean and wider history than the crude outline I will sketch, but in my mind at least, Greek myths cover a period in which our species moved from fear of nature and its monsters and the phenomena of fire, thunder, tidal waves, earthquakes, volcanoes, plague, and all the disasters that befall us in the world, towards a feeling that we might try to master, or at least manage, these apparently mysterious forces. At first we gave them divine identities. Gods of storm, sea, sky, harvest and war, nymphs and local deities of rivers, mountains, meadows and trees. We imagined that the best we could do to improve our lives was to worship and placate these powers through sacrifice and prayer. But slowly, fields and groves were systematically harvested. Fire became friend, not foe. As sea levels stabilized, harbors could be built, allowing marine trade with other lands. An alphabet spread, creating a vector for new ideas and apprehensions. In short, what we call civilization began. The great forces that once we bowed before and appeased seemed less strange and inexplicable. The power of the caste of priests and hierophants who interceded between us and the gods did not disappear, of course, but the stability, peace, and cheaper calories that civilization and agriculture brought allowed the rise of thought, education, art, and poetry. What the German philosopher Karl Jaspers called the Axial Age saw the founders of Confucianism, Taoism, Jainism, Buddhism, and Zoroastrianism, Confucius, Lao Tse, Mahavira, Siddhartha, and Zarathustra, all living at the same time, alongside Old Testament prophets such as Elijah, Jeremiah, and Isaiah, Greek thinkers like Heraclitus, Pythagoras, and Anaxagoras breathed the same air too. This constituted what has been called the Great Leap of Being, and it brought along with it skepticism, doubt, free inquiry, and many of the fundamental building blocks of modern thought, all contemporaneous on two sides of the world that had no intercourse with each other. Those who like to see history through the lens of economics have pointed out that on those same continents, coinage too appeared at just that same exact time. As I have acknowledged, history is never quite as convenient as such a beguiling and overarching idea suggests. Nonetheless, the Axial Age designation does remind us of a startling development in our species which cannot be denied, no matter how inexact, exaggerated, and pat it might be for some tastes. As the Italians neatly phrase it, se non è vero, è ben trovato. Even if it isn't quite true, it's well founded. At any rate, humankind moved on from the gods. The gods no longer appeared before us, or demanded sacrifice of us, no longer mated with us, commanded us, cursed us, or cast us up to the heavens as constellations. Except they are still here. Whenever we find our reason wrangling with our instinct, Apollo and Dionysus are contending within us. We contain them all. The cheek and cheerfulness of Hermes, the wisdom of Athena, the rage of Ares, the homeliness of Hestia, the craft of Hephaestus, the pride and propriety of Hera, the majesty of Zeus, and the capricious inconsistency, beauty, savagery, insight, glory and madness of the whole blessed pantheon.